our counterterrorism and law enforcement professionals at every level, federal, state, and local, are working together around the clock to prevent attacks and to keep us safe. And we are incredibly grateful for their service today and every single day.
From Donald Trump Jr. And he said, if I had a bowl of Skittles and I told you just three would kill you, would you take a handful? That's our Syrian refugee crisis. He said, let's end the politically correct agenda that doesn't put America first.
I want to repeat what we've said before. If you see something suspicious, then you need to say something. Contact local law enforcement. In the meantime, I would ask that the press try to refrain from getting out ahead of the investigation.
I heard I was criticized for calling it correctly. What I said was exactly correct. I should be a newscaster because I called it before the news.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09, and today is Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell, and welcome to another business day. We have lots to talk about today. The Federal Reserve Open Market Committee begins its meeting today, 2 days of meetings that could end in an interest rate hike. There are some on Wall Street who believe that the pricing yesterday was in preparation for a possible rate hike. A few people are changing their minds about whether Janet Yellen will actually pull the lever tomorrow. And it is at least I am starting to think that maybe she will, based on what I'm hearing. There are some in the market that think so, too, even though the odds are against it. That's happening. Big story there. Later in this broadcast, we're going to be talking with the president-elect of the Society of Professional Journalists. Journalists from all around the world, around the country, are meeting this week, and we're going to talk to her about the challenges facing journalism. Also, that new Gallup poll out last week that shows many Americans distrust mass media, including we journalists, to deliver the news. But first, let's go to the WGN Market Desk and find out what's happening around the world today. You heard some of the numbers from Vic, generally pointing up. The arrows are pointing up this morning. Dow futures up 47. The NASDAQ and S&P futures up as well. In Europe, generally a pretty good morning, although a few of the indices have turned negative within the last hour. And in Asia, generally a lower night as well. Here in this country, we're also seeing oil trading lower, off about 16 cents a barrel. Some big tech news yesterday. GoPro made its return to the scene, finally introducing a few new products, chief among them, a new drone called the Karma. Yesterday's event televised on a line for investors and for those interested in this was a big deal. And the CEO of GoPro was very excited, to say the least, about introducing his new product.
So much more than a drone, right? Yeah! Ah! It's the removable stabilizer. It's the grip. It's the controller. And yes, the drone. All together in the included backpack for $799.
That's GoPro CEO Nick Woodman on stage. Obviously very excited about his new drone. There's a couple of other introductions as well. There's a new version of the classic camera, some new software as well. But the drone, the Karma drone, obviously the big deal. It folds up and goes into a backpack. And under $800, which is rare for the kind of technology this is. And the high level of technology, you'd probably pay something more than $1,000 for one of its competitors, at least based on what we've seen early on. Also this morning, the Senate is set to take a closer look at the proposed $66 billion merger of American seed and weed killer Monsanto and German medicine and farm chemical maker Bayer. The two companies announced last week that they had reached a deal for purchase. This is just the first of many, many, many hurdles that this deal has to go through before it actually makes it to the final stage, which may take a year or more. There's also a report today that this movement called social entrepreneurism is facing a few challenges. There is some greater support from the public, governments, and investors. But more is needed, according to members of this organization and this movement who've been meeting in San Francisco. They wrapped up a conference last week. While progress overcoming those obstacles is healthy and growing, the people at the conference called SOCAP say they have more to do, but they leave a little a bit more energized than when they arrive.
I hope that over the course of the week, you've had a chance to reflect on some of the themes that we've tried to present here. The idea that the why of impact investing and social enterprise is just as important as the how, and that we should all strive to really keep those front of mind as often as possible. That understanding who is at the table and being really thoughtful about that is a practice we can all cultivate every day, and that I'm trying to get better at every day.
There's also a big social entrepreneur conference summit happening outside of the United Nations meeting this week in New York. So all of this is front and center. It made us ask the question, what, how, why? And we thought we would bring in one of our local experts on this. Dr. Christine Murphy is a professor at NIU. She's also a business person, and she runs the business, the Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Northern Illinois University. She's with us this morning on the Opening Bell. Good morning. It's good to have you on because, you know,
we asked
the question amongst ourselves, just what is social entrepreneurship?
Yeah, that's a great question. This idea of engaging the market for not just to make a profit, but to also have social or environmental returns, it's not a totally new concept. It's been around for a long time. I think it's just in the most recent, like 20 or 30 years, is coming together, kind of merging the kind of social sector with the business market and saying, okay, we can't just rely on governments and, just this other section to take care of some of our really, you know, significant problems we have globally. So how do we, you know, engage commercial strategies and business techniques in order to create sustainable and scalable models?
I want to get into this, the nuts and bolts of it more, but it's getting a lot of high-profile attention this week in New York as the United Nations General Assembly gets underway. I want to talk a little bit about that, and we'll get into what you're teaching students as our conversation with Dr. Christine Mooney continues this morning. She's with the Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Northern Illinois University, our guest this morning on the Opening Bell.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, Asian shares were mostly lower overnight, investors waiting for potential policy moves by the U.S. Federal Reserve. Yesterday, U.S. markets were essentially unchanged, the Dow closing off 3.5 points, the S&P 500 down fractionally, and the NASDAQ 9.5 points lower. Expect more hand-wringing today as Fed policymakers begin 2 days of discussions on interest rates. An announcement is set for Wednesday afternoon. The head of Wells Fargo is expected to apologize before a congressional panel today for betraying customers' trust. The bank has been dealing with the fallout over allegations that it opened up millions of unauthorized accounts, moved money into those accounts, and then signed up customers for online banking in order to meet sales targets. And 70,000 American Airlines employees are switching to new uniforms today, the first in nearly 3 decades. The fashion overhaul is one of the last and most visible signs that the American-U.S. Airways integration is complete. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. We're on with Dr. Christine Mooney today from Northern Illinois University. She is a professor of business there, also the director of the Center for Social Entrepreneurship. And we were talking before the break, Dr. Mooney, just about what social entrepreneurship is. It is getting a lot of high-profile attention this week and last week. There was the big SOCAP conference that we referenced coming into the show. And then on the UN Day, on UN Week this week, they're having big meetings out in New York. So this is getting a lot of traction. Why is that, do you think? Why is it suddenly becoming a thing?
Well, I think it's really a kind of a perfect storm, right? We have these huge social and environmental issues. We have almost half of our, you know, population still living under poverty, and that's 3 billion people, 1 billion still under a dollar a day. We still have a lot of big challenges that government, while they're trying their best, are not able to kind of really solve. I think in 2000, the UN set the millennial goals of eradicating poverty, decreasing child mortality, increasing maternal health. So I think they kind of spurred it. But I also think one big piece is that we have this new generation coming up where engaging with the social good is just part of their schooling. They're coming up. So when I was a kid, I don't know, when you were a kid, you know, we volunteer. That's been going on for a long time, but it was kind of outside of school. Where I see with my children and the students that I work with at NIU, this is part of their school day. So it's almost part of their work. this idea of merging, what am I going to do with my day? What is my, you know, day job with a purpose, with doing something that's impactful, is very much, I don't want to say it's in their DNA, but it almost feels like it is, because this is what they've known. And so I think it's just a new way of thinking about how we can solve some of these really significant problems that we're facing.
It's interesting you say it's in their DNA, because the surveys seem to suggest that they want this out of people and businesses that they deal with. Give us a sense of, as you teach your students this and see this in action, how it plays out in real life. So give us a scenario of how a social entrepreneur does good in his community or his or her community.
Sure. So with our students, we have a minor and we now have a new major. And so a lot of our students are like majoring in other things like marketing and accounting and things. And so when they kind of are exposed to this, they think, well, how can I incorporate this in my daily life? So for some students, they get involved in, you know, volunteer work, just like any nonprofit, but they're taking what they're learning in the classroom and they're kind of volunteering with what their expertise is, even at a younger age, right? So giving them kind of the tools to say, you know, as an expert at your level in social media marketing, you can really help a nonprofit. But we also see them kind of moving forward and saying, how do I, you know, find a job that can help me, you know, do good in my daily life. So I think sometimes we think about this new generation as thinking about them as customers, like wanting to buy impactful goods, but really they're looking for companies that are doing this, that they can move up into those positions. So if I'm a marketing student and I want to go work for a company in marketing, that's what I want to do. But how do I then look into the company and their social responsibility and what is the movement for me, and how quickly can I move into that and be impactful? And then, of course, we also see some students who at some point, most of our students, when they first graduate, I think undergraduates don't go straight into, you know, launching a social business. But at some point, that's what they want to do. So many of them are looking for, as these social enterprises are growing and needing, you know, marketers and operation people and finance folks, they're looking for jobs in these startups as well. That's kind of the path we see.
Yeah, and we've profiled one or two of these here on the opening bell. One of them that our listeners may remember is called Flowers for Dreams here in Chicago, a flower company that actually donates some of its profits to help different organizations. And our producer of the show last week ordered flowers, and some of it went to the Shedd Aquarium. But there is an example in Oregon where there's a pint public house that donates some of their money from a pint. Have a pint, change the world was their tagline, I believe, where they donate to local charities. So this is happening everywhere. And is it something, Dr. Mooney, that we have to do this, otherwise there will be people that will just be so in, we're becoming so populated, but we have to think this way, don't we?
Absolutely. Well, that's my bias. Right. I mean, I do absolutely think that the evidence shows that this is what we've been doing in the past is not working, and the problems are getting worse. The population is increasing, resources are decreasing. And here's the thing, we know that the business model works. We know that when we engage the market, when we sell a product or service, that there is a level of sustainability that we can gain as a business and scale. And while in some cases the traditional nonprofit that just focuses on donations is necessary for some sectors, we also think that if we can think more creatively to engage, not only whether you're a nonprofit or for profit, we're kind of agnostic to that, but to engage the market, to sell, to get customers to find value in your product or service will help sustain and scale the business. And if you're a social business, then you're doing social good on top of that. And so I just feel like this is the way to go. This is how we help eradicate these problems.
And this is something that we're actually seeing in real life. You're probably teaching your students that companies can survive this way. I mean, I know some in another generation may be really concerned about bottom line, and when they get to that point, investor value. But this is a way where companies are making money off of this.
Yeah, I mean, I would say they're not just surviving, they're thriving. And so you have companies that, you know, again, if you engage the market and you create something valuable for the market and customers will buy it, then investors are going to come and say, you know, I want more. And so, like, here's an example. In New York, Grayston Bakery, I don't know if you've heard of that. You've possibly eaten some of their goods because they actually sell their brownies to Ben & Jerry's. And so they make this amazing brownie that's, so, you know, their product is amazing. I just bought them last week and they're really good. But they've been around since 1982, way before we started talking about social entrepreneurship. So what makes them a social entrepreneur? Well, they hire anyone. So they hire anyone who has a felon, who has any kind of record, because they're looking at this this group in society that's kind of been ignored and giving them a second chance. And so I think a model looking at that, like what is our social good, the impact, but not kind of giving up on the value of our product or service is the real key.
Dr. Christine Mooney is with the Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Northern Illinois University. Actually, she's the director and she's a business professor at Northern as well. And you can follow this online at NIU Causes One. You can also find Northern Illinois University online as well and find Dr. Christine Mooney and her business class. We're going to follow you, if you don't mind, Dr. Mooney, to see how this goes and see what your challenges are moving forward. We'd like to touch base again.
Okay, that's great.
All right, thank you. Have a nice day.
From ABC News Tech Trends, a new app aimed at helping the homeless. It's called GiveSafe, and it's designed to connect givers directly with receivers, a program being piloted on the streets of Seattle. GiveSafe users can help a struggling person they encounter on the street without handing them cash.
The word struggling is important in that not everyone wants to actively leave the situation, and we don't want to help someone who doesn't want to be helped.
Jonathan Kumar is creator of GiveSafe. He says it works through small Bluetooth-enabled beacons about the size of a quarter, which are handed out through nonprofit shelters. While you walk the streets, the app will alert you when there's a beacon nearby. Users will see the person's picture and bio, and with a tap, transfer money to that person, money that can be spent with any partners of GiveSafe.
Oh, I've got, you know, $100 on this beacon. Would you help me get what I need?
More than 100 of Seattle's homeless are already wearing the beacons. With Tech Trends, I'm Mona Rivera, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. We report on a lot of polls this time of year in political season, but one last week really made us journalists wince in a bad way. Just 32% of Americans now say they trust the media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly. That's the lowest level since 1972 when Gallup began polling. Some in the media organizations and some in Gallup. A Gallup survey researcher said there may be a reason for that, and it could be this.
I'm not running against crooked Hillary. I'm running against the crooked media. That's what I'm running against.
Sometimes we get very divided, partly because our politics and our media specifically tries to divide them. And splinter.
This administration has prided itself and made transparency in government a genuine priority. And he believes the American people were well served by that. He believes that our government is more effective because of the way that he has made that principle a genuine priority.
The newspaper's going to hell. Maybe we'll start thinking about taking their press credentials away from them.
We can't stop doing the work just because we're at this all-time low.
My colleague here in Chicago, Lynn Sweet of the Sun-Times, appearing recently on CNN, Brian Stelter, the host of the show, actually asked his viewers at the top of it, do you trust me? And so that's a question that we want to ask today, and we thought we would go right to the source, literally. Lynn Walsh is the president-elect of the Society of Professional Journalists. She's a journalist from San Diego herself. She is meeting with all of the rest of my colleagues at a national conference this week, along with the Radio, Television, Digital News Association. And Lynn, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell. Congratulations on your election.
Thank you so much, Steve. Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Did you wince like I did when you saw this Gallup poll? And what do you think is fueling this?
I mean, absolutely. It's hard not to when you work so hard in a field and you're trying so hard to get the message out there and inform the public. I think, you know, right now, one, I think those clips that you just played, that definitely plays into it. We're getting it from all sides, right? It's always the media's fault. No matter what you do, no matter how transparent you can be, it seems sometimes that you're always not doing enough or doing it incorrectly. I think the other aspect of it, I think, you know, online and on the internet, anyone can really act as or be acting potentially as a journalist. And sometimes that does hurt the reputation of those that are doing it ethically, that are reporting and covering the world around us responsibly, when there are people that are just sharing, you know, whatever they would want online, and people may see that as, oh, it's the media. You know, we get lumped into just one big group when it's not necessarily, well, that's not the case.
And you bring up a good point there. The lines are blurring considerably, and that's why this meeting is happening this week, where we all get together and hone our skills and talk about these issues. Because when we become journalists, when we study and spend our lives doing this, it's not just to make money, because we don't make a lot of money. We do this. We take it very seriously. What would you like to tell the public about what it is that we do and how we do it?
Yeah, I think, and I want to also stress, you know, I am a definite supporter of online media, and I think that people can not maybe go to a journalism school through the traditional routes and can still be responsible journalists and responsible with what they're reporting, but we have to keep certain things in mind. And the one thing I will point to is the Society of Professional Journalists, our code of ethics. You know, we talk about seek truth and report it. Minimize harm when you're talking to victims. When you're talking about anyone, you want to make sure that you're keeping, you know, their privacy and in their situation also in the back of your mind. We're all individuals. Also, you know, act independently. You also want to be accountable for yourself, for your reporting, and also being transparent, which I think is one of the biggest keys right now to, if you really want to be a responsible journalist, you know, being transparent about how you're reporting, what you're reporting on, and, you know, how you're doing it. Show the public, link to the actual source documents, link to your questions.
And transparency is a huge issue right now, especially in the presidential campaign. People have asked me repeatedly, why is it such a big deal that you keep asking for all of these documents from the presidential candidates, their health records, their tax returns? It's about transparency, not just in the political races, but in government, too, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we actually, our current president wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that just was published late last week, where late last year, we met with SPJ leaders and also 50 other open government and journalism groups, met with White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, talking about transparency issues. After that meeting, we followed up. We did not hear back. He then published a letter to the editor calling for journalists to give credit to President Obama and his administration for improvements in government transparency. And, you know, we couldn't sit silently by, because really officials are blocking requests to talk to specific staff people, especially at a national level. But this also happens at a local level. You know, you receive long delays in answering interview requests. Now it seems, especially in Washington, you know, information on background has become a norm. And that's just not how we do our jobs. We want to tell the public exactly who we're getting the information from, what they're saying. We want that access. And if that access is being closed off, it's harder for us to do our jobs. But more importantly, it's less information for the public, which just isn't going to help anyone in the long run.
And there are equal opportunity offenders, too. We're not just after Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. The White House has been very lax about providing stuff. But this is happening in small towns all over America, where freedom of information requests are being challenged. They're not being met. There are laws, these Open Meetings Act laws and freedom of information laws, and it seems every season there's an attempt to roll them back. What is the status of that movement, those laws across the country, in your view?
Yeah, so as a local, working local journalist, I mean, I see it every day, unfortunately. I think the first thing I think sometimes for the public to understand is these are laws that are in place for you. They're not in place for journalists. Anyone has the right to submit a Freedom of Information Act request at the federal level, but then probably more importantly at your local level, look at your state laws. Try and actually use the acts that exist and try to ask for information. See what that response is. The more we practice those, it's only going to get better. I do think right now, in my reporting, I know too, you get the answer of no, or you can't have this information more often than not. And you know, sometimes the reasons, you know, privacy sometimes makes sense. Other times it's just they don't want to give it to you and they're going to say no and we have to fight back. And unfortunately, in most states, it means you have to file a lawsuit and that costs money. And then that is prohibited prohibitive for us to then get the information.
Yeah, because newsrooms across the country, I don't think people realize this either, have been cut dramatically. There are fewer resources. We are lucky to have our jobs, I think, in many cases. Let me ask you, because our time is running short here, another of the issues that I know you guys have been talking about down there is the group called No Notoriety. And this is a group formed after all of these mass shootings we've been having. It's a group of parents and victims' families who don't want us to use names of these shooters after these incidents. What was that discussion like? And is that something that the Society of Professional Journalists that our organizations might actually consider?
So, you know, I think each member kind of, you know, has their own individual opinion on this, but it does go specifically, this movement, to a part of our code where it talks about that minimize harm. You know, we have a responsibility to report what is happening and report it accurately, report it ethically. So if there is a shooter that does go into a nightclub like what happened in Orlando, the public does have a right, and I believe we have a responsibility to say who is responsible. Now, when you beyond that, that's where I think there are some different areas where you can go. Do you use his or her photo every time you mention their name? How many times do you use their name? So I think there is a part that even in our code we focus on, a minimizing harm. Do you use it maybe once or twice, and do you not use the photo again? Do you mention their name at the beginning of an article or at the beginning of something online or in a tweet, and then you just reference them, you know, by shooter or the suspect, something like that? I think there are ways to do it. I don't know that we've reached an agreement yet. I don't know that we would go as far as saying don't ever use the name, because it is part of our responsibility to report the name, because that is what's happening around us.
Lynn Walsh, the president-elect of the Society of Professional Journalists. We're out of time. I'm sure you understand that, Lynn.
Yes, absolutely.
It's good of you to be with us, and sorry I couldn't be down there. Lots of interesting topics. We'll maybe try to get into some more of those as we discuss the business of journalism. But congratulations again to you, and thank you for getting up and being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone has a good morning.
All right. 5:49 here on the opening bell. Again, Lynn Walsh, the Society of Professional Journalists, president-elect. Lynn, by the way, is an investigative producer and a reporter at NBC7 in San Diego, as well as the president of this giant organization of professional journalists.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
5:54 on the WGN market desk. Dow futures pointing up 54 points. S&P NASDAQ futures higher as well. The latest on commodities and agriculture now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Another tough day in the livestock markets at the Mercantile Exchange yesterday. October lean hogs down 60 cents for the day. The October live cattle contract almost finished in positive territory. It was down a nickel a hundredweight at $107.90. September feeder cattle ended the day down 12 cents at $135.45. Again, ample meat supplies given as the reason. Taking a look at grain trade yesterday, for the third straight session, soybeans ended higher. Strength in vegetable oil markets, some technical buying, corn turned higher on chart-based buying, and Chicago wheat finished mixed, held in check by an ongoing disruption in Egyptian wheat imports. We're a little behind the average on harvest for this time of the year. The weekly report yesterday showed 9% of corn harvested as of Sunday, 4% of the soybeans harvested as of Sunday. California continues to make agricultural news, becoming the first state to say legally you have to pay farm workers overtime. And now another one. California will begin regulating greenhouse gas emissions tied to dairy cows and landfills under legislation signed by Governor Jerry Brown. For dairy farmers, that means they'll have to reduce methane emissions from manure to 40% below their 2013 levels by the year 2030. I wonder what we did when we had millions of buffalo roaming the range. Well, that's another story. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
I think we killed them all. I think that's what happened. And then we grew them back. that may have been what happened, Orion. But it's a very valid question, Orion Samuels, and thank you. Have a wonderful day. Just a couple of final notes. One final note on the market calendar, the WGN market calendar today. The big story ahead is the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee begins its meeting, 2 days of meetings. Policymakers will discuss whether or not to raise interest rates. One economic report due out today by the government, the Commerce Department, will reveal how many home developers broke ground last month. New home construction has been on the upswing, with July reaching its strongest pace in 6 months. That could drive the markets as we move forward. We'll continue to follow your money throughout the morning on the Steve Cochran Show coming up next, and we'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning for another edition of The Opening Bell. Have a great day. I'm Steve Krasanich.